It is like a finger pointing away to the moon.
Don't concentrate on the finger or you will miss all that heavenly glory.
Hey, partner, that is some finger there you're packing, huh?
Welcome and greetings to the V-Cinema Podcast. My name's Josh.
What was that? An exhibition? We need emotional content. Try again.
Yes, to the V-Cinema Podcast, Episode 3. This is Coffin John, and as you just heard, that was Josh. So how are you doing today, Josh?
Just having a blast, man.
All right, excellent.
Be insulted.
And speaking of having a blast, we're recording on Valentine's Day. What did you do today on this day of love and romance, Josh?
Oh, man, I hung out with a bunch of dudes.
That's
pretty much it.
That's very nice. Well, I didn't fare much better. I just basically stayed home and did a bunch of schoolwork. But we hope everyone out there had a nice Valentine's Day, spent it with some loved ones, and had a general good time.
We can't all be losers like us.
Yeah, but
unfortunately.
But looking at Twitter today, it looks like there were a lot of losers like us, unfortunately.
Pathetic losers, man. God. Yep.
Oh. Just everyone's posting the usual, I'll watch this movie alone.
That kind of thing. In my dark basement.
Yeah.
Sad. Makes me sick.
Right.
Okay, what now?
Yep, so anyway, so this is episode 3, and as we talked about last episode, we're reviewing 1989's Tetsuo, The Iron Man, by Shinya Tsukamoto.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And then
sounds like a good movie.
Yeah, it's well, we'll talk about that later. And of course, we'll be doing the usual The Block.
Big time.
Yeah, you know, we need theme music for The Block. You know, we should have something.
The Block.
Yeah, okay, so that'll be next show anyway. So for those of you who don't know The Block, it's basically a series of short segments, the Netflix Instant Watch, Show and Tell, and the Twitter question. The Twitter question, by the way, this episode is, what movie do you consider a postmodern masterpiece? Wow, this is, sounds like we'll get some interesting replies.
Oh, it does.
Yeah. But in the meantime, let's go into just talk about what's been happening with our lives. Well, what have you been doing, Josh? What have you been watching, reading, playing, enjoying, etc.?
Mostly just movies, man. Movies. It's been how many weeks now since we were last recorded?
I think it's been three.
Probably 3 weeks, gosh. Yes, I've been watching a lot of stuff, so I could go over all of it, but I'll just kind of like breeze through most of these, I think.
Okay.
I got Perot le Feu. Is that how you pronounce that? Godard? Are you familiar with it?
How's it spelled?
P-I-E-R-R-O-T. Space L-E space F-O-U.
I think it's Piero le Feu or something.
It's something, man. Godard directed. I couldn't understand what they were saying. They were speaking some kind of other language something. But it was a pretty decent movie. I liked it. I liked it. I'm say pretty decent, but it was actually probably my second favorite from Godard so far. Band of Outsiders probably my favorite so far. Breathless might be third place probably. But then I watched Orphan, which I've been hearing about big time.
Mm-hmm.
Liked it a lot. Slaughter Hotel, did not like whatsoever. Ninja 3, The Domination, Off the Chain. M from Fritz Lang, really good, that one. What Have You Done to Solange? That was another really good one. Texas Audio, Franco Nero, in a non-Django role. That was really a lot of fun. I believe Fernando Baldi directed that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That was really good. Get Mean, starring Tony Anthony, also directed by Fernando Baldi. That was really good.
Mm-hmm.
Your Vice the Locked Room and Only I Have the Key. I reviewed that from a website and loved it. High Crime, once again, starring Franco Nero. That was pretty amazing right there. That was probably, it might be one of my favorite roles that I've seen Franco Nero in. Saw School on Fire while I was doing preparation work for my Ringo Lam article, which you can visit on varietycelluloid.net.
Oh, yeah, I read that article. That was very good. I enjoyed it.
Oh, yeah. Crow Zero, which at first I didn't really find myself as big a fan as everybody else, but the more I let it sink in, the more I kind of turned to like it, and now like I consider myself a fan of it. Crank 2, watch that. That was pretty freaking awesome. It was like a big budget trauma flick. Lizard in a Woman's Skin. Truthfully, I don't know. I probably need to watch it again. Have you seen
it? That's the Fulci one, right? It's a giallo?
Yeah, and it's really weird.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I believe I've seen it, but I think it's been such a long time, I don't remember.
It's like I watched it maybe a week ago, and I don't remember much about it myself. I think I was like distracted, so I don't know if... I don't know. I don't know if I was very fair with it. I don't know. Taken, I watched that. It was pretty freaking
cool. Oh, that's
cool.
Liam Neeson one, right?
Yeah, Dark right. Man. Yeah, he's beating people up and stuff. It's really cool. The Card Player. Ooh. I watched that like a couple days ago. Dario Argento.
I believe I warned you about that one, too. Sometime.
Here's my note. It says garbage. Just utterly garbage.
Yeah. I would agree with that.
How does someone who made such interesting, just amazing looking films in the past, how do they go from that to The Card Player, man? It's like he doesn't even know how to, you know, make an interesting shot anymore, you know? I watched Do You Like Hitchcock not too long ago. I might have talked about it in the last episode, I'm not sure. But I watched that, and I'll give it to that movie that it at least had, like, an interesting set that it was taking place in from the majority of it. The main character, have you seen it?
Yes.
Yeah, the main character at least has that apartment with the view outside to the other apartment and stuff. That's kind of interesting, you know. You can get some interesting stuff out of that. But Card Player had nothing going for it.
And I'm looking at the IMDb right now, and I can see what might be part of the problem is that there are actually 1, 2, 3, 4 writers.
Yeah,
I mean, Argento developed the story and the screenplay, but it looks like he collaborated with a Franco Ferrini, and there's someone who's actually credited as doing dialogue. I'm not sure what that means.
Yeah, movie was terrible. Utterly sucked. I watched God Told Me To, which was a pretty interesting ending, kind of. You know, I wasn't digging the ending too much. Have you seen that?
Oh, yeah. I actually enjoyed it.
Blood Freak, best movie ever. It's like, basically it's right up there with Citizen Kane. I think it fits in right there. Orson Welles' The Trial, Metropolis. Basically, if you're into those type of movies, art house and stuff like that, then Blood Freak is the movie for you.
And if you want to hear a very honest review of that movie, you might want to check out the Cinema Snobs video review of it. That's on the cinemasnob.com, right?
Yeah.
I think that fits in a little more closely with reality.
I haven't seen his he's got an episode?
He does, yes.
Oh, I've got to see it, because that movie sucked so bad. Well, I don't know. I say sucked, but man, it was entertaining. Oh, watch Blind Man with more Tony Anthony. He plays a blind dude, and he has to find his 50 women, man.
Well, you've mentioned Tony Anthony 3 times now, so you might want to talk a little bit about who this person is for those who don't know.
Tony Anthony. He was paired with Fernando Baldi quite a bit back in the old spaghetti western days, and he had a series called The Stranger.
Right.
He did The Stranger, Stranger Returns. There's another one, I forget, it's like Stranger in Another Land, or something like that, where he was in Japan, actually. And then Get Mean, and he also did Blind Man along the way. And then he did some 3D movies back in the 80s as well. But Tony Anthony's probably one of the maybe lesser known and maybe less respected leading men in spaghetti westerns and stuff, but I actually kind of dig his movies. I think he's pretty awesome. It's like a blend of comedy, but not quite as over the top as like Terrence Hill or something like that. So I dig him.
Right. And you mentioned that he did a couple of 3D movies in the 1980s, and actually those two movies, one of them which is Coming at You from 1981, and the second which was The Treasure of the Four Crowns. Both of those movies are held responsible for sort of the 80s 3D revival. So that in itself, I think, is kind of interesting that he's associated with those two movies.
Yeah, I haven't seen... You've seen Coming At You.
Yeah, I saw Coming At You a long time ago.
Yeah, it's being released, re-released, I think, pretty soon or whatever. What's the website? I forget. Coming At You Noir 3D.
Right.
Should be cool.
Yeah, and I think Treasure of the Four Crowns, I remember being one of the bigger Indiana Jones ripoffs. Yeah, in the day. I remember seeing the commercial on TV and thinking, wow, I want to see that in 3D. No way! You know, like that. Woo!
Then you got, what did I do? I got Fallen Angels with from Wong Kar Wai. I had only seen Chungking Express and As Tears Go By up until this point. I think As Tears Go By kind of put me off from seeing any Wong Kar Wai kind of. I didn't really like that movie that much. Yeah, Fallen Angels definitely impressed me. It's a lot more like Chungking Express than As Tears Go By.
Yeah, originally those two movies were supposed to be actually one movie.
Really?
I think he had pitched Chungking Express and Fallen Angels as actually one big film, but he wasn't able to get the funding, or I don't quite remember the story.
Yeah.
So he basically had to pitch them as two separate movies.
Yeah, that's probably for the best. Could you imagine like a four-hour movie with as much California Dreamin' as Chungking Express had?
Well, I thought that song was used very well in the movie, actually.
Oh, I love that movie, and I love that song for the first half of it or so, but after a while, that song starts to grate the nerves.
Okay.
Watch Snake of June from this guy. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. He's Shinya Tsukamoto.
Oh, wait. I think I know him. He also directs.
What was that? House of the Devil. Yeah, that's my last movie I got listed here. And, yeah, I watched that a few days ago, and I loved it. Just like everybody else. Nah, it's really good. It's like... I liked it. You know, I first heard about it, I think, through Miles and Katie on Shosho. And, they explained, the way they explained it to me was, or to me, Lord, the way they explained it was that it was more of a throwback to, you know, more relaxed paced horror films and a lot less jump scares and more about atmosphere and just being creepy and stuff like that. And, you know, when I first heard that, I was like, well, that sounds pretty awesome. And sure enough, that's what the movie delivers, you know. It's definitely more of a throwback to, so I guess, stuff like The Shining or Rosemary's Baby or, you know, stuff that doesn't jump right out and, you know, go, hey, I'm a horror movie. You guys like those, right? It's more relaxed, and it takes its time. There's a lot of character development, especially in the first half of the movie. So what you been up to, John?
Well, let's see. Last episode I mentioned that I took a vacation and I was in Hawaii visiting friends and just, you know, hanging out for a week. You know, normally you would associate going to Hawaii with going to the beach or sightseeing and everything, and that's...
Which is what you
did,
right?
No, it's actually the opposite of what I did. I actually hung out a lot at my friend's place and we watched a lot of movies.
What?
The reason being is because I actually lived in Hawaii several years ago. I got my bachelor's there. So I didn't really need to see anything of the island. I've been all around everywhere pretty much.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just wanted to just hang out. And plus, you know, another bad thing is, as I've mentioned, I'm in school. So I also had to stay back a lot of times and do schoolwork, which was kind of like sort of an, I guess you could say, an anti-vacation. But we did watch a lot of stuff, and I did watch as well. I've been watching some stuff here at home. I guess in a sort of achronological order, I can mention that I watched Departures. That's Yojiro Takita's film. That's the one that won the Academy Award for Best Foreign Picture last year. That was excellent, really excellent film.
Yeah.
I was surprised how well it moved from being... you know, a melodrama to a black comedy to really a poem on life and death. I wouldn't say it's as good as, for example, I really recommended Ikiru last episode. It's not as good as something like that, but it's in that same kind of ballpark where it's kind of teaching you to sort of live your life and do your best and be your best at what you do. So I really enjoyed it a lot. Let's see, I also watched Blood of Rebirth, and I know that you've been wanting to hear about that one. That's Toshiaki Toyoda's first film in, I think it's been 4 years now, right?
Since Hanging Garden,
yeah,
probably. What was it? He might have done that. Was that 04?
405. Toshiaki Toyoda, if you don't know about him, has also directed other films such as...
Blue Spring, Hanging Garden, Nine Souls, Porno Star, and Unchained.
Right.
That's his whole filmography.
Right.
Right there.
He's very much an up-and-coming director who has a lot of promise. Yep. As for Blood of Rebirth, I was a little disappointed with it. It's set up to be like a fable, and I believe it's based on an old Japanese fable.
Yeah, from what I understand.
And they got the look of it correct, and the story is there, but there are just some of the dialogue is a little, I guess you could say, maybe I should drag out the old...
Setting it off early.
Yep, the dialogue was a little pretentious. A little goofy at times, and there are some scenes that go on for a little too long, and I just thought that, you know, it was only like maybe, I think, 90 minutes long, but a good 5, 6, 7 minutes could have been cut out easily, or maybe some story could have been added in, but a little disappointing. I think it's worth a rental if it comes out. Yeah,
it better. I still want to see it. I mean, I trust your opinion, but I got to finish off as well.
Oh, sure, of course. You always have to see things for yourself.
It might break my heart, though. It's going to suck.
You know what? He's young enough where he can do a whole bunch of our films, too.
Yeah, exactly. Like the sequel to Blue Spring.
So anyway, since I took a vacation on the plane, of course, I had to watch a couple of movies. I watched Where the Wild Things Are and Clive Owen's Craptacular, The Boys Are Back. And
it's basically
a Lifetime. It's a Lifetime movie, but you know, Lifetime movies are usually for about women, right? So this is about a man who loses his wife and is trying to reconnect with his sons, and it's suitably sappy. And so anyway, let's see. I also watched Zombieland, which I thought was a little bit overhyped. It was okay, but nothing special. Mm-hmm. I mean, in my opinion, we're sort of going through this phase with zombie movies where, you know, we can say a lot of zombie movies are crap. And, you know, I think a lot of people hype Zombieland as being a really great zombie movie, but to me, it's kind of like you're saying it's the king of the crap, you know? But it wasn't bad, but it was sort of... The jokes were a little too projected, I would say. Yeah.
I remember when Mike Bracken, our friend from the HarGeek.com, remember when I think it was him, he used to say, you know, oh, where are all the zombie movies at? Where are all the zombie movies at? But, God, he got that that question answered, because thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth seeing if you can get it on rental, you know. Let's see, I've also watched Jennifer's Body, The Fourth Kind.
Ooh.
Daybreakers, A Bitch Slap, which if you happen to follow me on Twitter, you know that I really hated.
Loved it. Yes, he did.
Well, here's the problem. I think with a movie like Bitch Slap, you know, you get to the point where you say, okay, this movie is garbage. And then people say, well, you know what? It's meant to be garbage. But I think that's kind of a weakness, you know, because when you think of it, you are making a movie that has an automatic defense to anything that you can consider criticism, that's kind of ridiculous in my opinion.
Yeah.
I mean, for example, if you take something like Grindhouse, which is, you know, an homage to exploitation film, you know, it's, you know, in general, both films are classy homages to that period of time. Whereas Bitch Slap is just kind of like someone who was thinking that he was making something that's homaging that time period, but is actually making something that is mocking that time period. You know, I mean, it just seems like maybe he watched a couple of movies and just thought, okay, well, exploitation movies are violence, tits, and stupidity. You know, which Bitch Slap is. And that's kind of the problem with it. It doesn't really homage those movies. It just basically takes these raw elements out of them that, you know, I mean, exploitation movies more than that. There's a lot more that we get into for exploitation. Yeah. And, you know, you know, even our movie today, Tetsuo, is, I think, a good example of something that's going beyond genre, going beyond, you know, the confines of what genre film is, right?
Yeah, it's not what you'd call an ordinary horror movie.
So I thought in general, you know, Bitch Slap was kind of stupid, but, you know, I think there's probably an audience out there, you know. I mean, they're probably, you know, the frat boys and, you know, Bud Light drinkers of the world, you know. I'm not too sure. I know that's going to piss some people off. But anyway, let me round off. I watched Daybreakers as well and Inglourious Bastards, which actually I really, really loved. I didn't get to see it in the theaters. I was just too busy. I was very impressed with it. Mm-hmm. I think Tarantino's really maturing and coming to his own as an excellent director. In fact, I would say that, you know, I think people criticize Inglourious Bastards, especially Eli Roth's role in it. To me, I can write that off as just being a little nepotism.
I think he gets a little bit more crap for that than he really deserves, you know, just because he's Eli Roth. I really didn't see, I mean, I guess I'm not from Boston or whatever, but I didn't see nothing too terribly wrong with
that. Well, it's not so much a performance, but, you know, in my opinion, the way I see it with Inglourious Bastards, Eli Roth, and Tarantino is that, hey, you have a friend who, you know, is also in the industry and everything, so, you know, you want to give jobs to your friends, right? That's very similar to me with the Asian film industry, you know, where you have directors being actors, actors being directors, and they're all helping each other out. So, you know, I would say performance notwithstanding, you know, I can certainly understand why Eli Roth was in that particular role. And I thought the only weakness actually with Inglourious Basterds is, and this might sound kind of strange, is that I think Tarantino has matured as a director, but I think he's kind of got to get away from his Tarantino-ness, which might sound kind of strange to say, but I thought the elements of the movie that I didn't like were those elements that were more directly Tarantino-like, you know, like the old Tarantino, I should say. Like, for example, when characters would appear, they would have the credits pop up on screen, you know, like, I can't remember which characters had that, but I just thought it was kind of unnecessary to have that. And there's also one scene where they're explaining that, you know, the old film is really flammable, blah, blah, blah. It's only like a 1 minute sequence, but I thought that really took me out of the greatness of the film, you know.
I think I like the fact, though, that, I mean, I understand what you're saying, but I'm not defending that. I'm saying that I think this film was a much, like, I love the Kill Bill films as well, and, you know, Death Proof, I was kind of, like, iffy on, but, yeah, I like Kill Bill and stuff like that, but this film felt like it was a step, you know, as much as it kept in that same regard of, you know, oh, I'm going to pay homage to, you know, every filmmaker I ever loved or whatever, it's felt like it was a little bit of a step away from that, even if it's not like a great leap away from it. I'm glad that he's at least moving somewhat away from that.
Well, yeah, definitely. I think the thing is that, again, I think there's that dichotomy of, you know, the old Tarantino, so to speak, and the new Tarantino. And I think those two Tarantinos are sort of fighting with each other. I don't want to say that, you know, I don't think Tarantino sits there and says, like, do I want to do it the old way or do I want to do this new way? But I think that he's trying to mix the two together and trying to come up with this new formula. And because Inglourious Basterds was a very confident Tarantino, one that says, you know, this is my vision, here we go, this is what I want to show you. Whereas, you know, you bring up Death Proof as an example, I kind of felt like the vision was there, but I almost felt that he had to maybe use some elements in the film that maybe he thought his audience was expecting, like the circular dialogue, you know, et cetera. I mean, if you take out a lot of the, for example, the dialogue, I think you come up with a really strong movie. Okay, well, anyway, so that's all the movies that I've watched recently. I just want to mention a couple books that I've been reading lately. I started this book called Showgirls, Teen Wolves, and Astro Zombies, a film critic's year-long quest to find the worst movie ever made. It's by Michael Adams, who is an Australian film journalist. As Josh mentioned, I posted that on the Varied Celluloid forums. And this is kind of an interesting book. It's basically Michael Adams is watching one bad movie per day for an entire year, trying to find the worst one. And actually, this kind of reminded me a lot of Heaven's Trash's project. For those of you who don't know Heaven's Trash, that's Will. He's doing a project in which... of course, every film geek has a big stack of films that he or she has bought and never watched, and he's trying to reduce his pile. So, he's watched over 100 so far. So anyway, his project sort of reminded me a lot of this Michael Adams' project. And so far, it's a very entertaining book. He goes through a lot of the typical Ed Wood type stuff, as well as, you know, the regular blaxploitation stuff, but then he does a lot of, you know, the commercial mainstream stuff, for example, Showgirls, from the title of the book.
Oh, yeah.
So it's a good mix of the obscure and the mainstream, and his thoughts, as well as, you know, a memoir of, you know, he's kind of like putting his family through the same hell that he's going through. So it's... overall, so far, an enjoyable read. I'm only 50% finished with it, though.
Does he talk about God Monster of Indian?
Don't know, don't care. So, I've also been reading a book by Ryu Murakami called Almost Transparent Blue. And actually, I'm rereading this. Mm-hmm. I've read this back in high school. This is a book that I'm reading for my blog, which is gaijinzoku.blogspot.com. Those of you who may read my blog may have seen that I did a dual review last time of Hear the Wind Sing. I did the film review as well as the book review, and I'm doing likewise for this particular book, Almost Transparent Blue. There was a movie out, which was, of course, based on this book. So I'll have that review up in my blog in about another probably 2 or 3 weeks, I guess. But for those of you who don't know, Ryu Murakami is, of course, an author. He's also a director, and he's a screenwriter out of Japan. His most famous thing here out in the West that he's done is he did the short story for Audition, which BK directed. He's also never directed his own films. He directed Tokyo Decadence, which was based on one of his stories. So overall, I've been enjoying those two books. Okay, well, stay tuned for our next segment. We're going to have a little discussion, and the topic of our discussion for this show is film review. So, yeah, we're basically talking about the film review process. So we'll be back in a little bit. See you then.
Did the earth move for you too, Josh? I know it moved for me.
Listen. Do you hear it? It's getting closer. Much closer. Don't be afraid. Be very, very afraid.
I've got a message for you. Ready for death.
I'm Gray. Take a journey with me through the dark side of cinema in the Dark Hours Horror Podcast. Find it at thedarkhours.net.
Terror has no shape. far beyond anything your mind could ever conceive.
So we're going off to our next segment of the show. This is our discussion segment, in which we basically take a topic and we discuss it to death.
Yep,
that's right. And in fact, since you in the listening audience might want to chime in and tell us what you think about a particular topic, or if you want to even suggest a topic to us, just give us a call or email us. Our voicemail line is 206-338-3864. And our email is
vcinema@varietcelluloid.net or easier, vcinema@yahoo.com.
Right, either one will get to us.
Same place.
So I chose the topic for this particular episode, and I wanted to talk about film review. And I chose this topic, well, first off, let me give a little context that neither Josh nor I are professional film reviewers. We are quite amateur. Of course, Josh has written a lot more reviews than I have. He writes for variedcelluloid.net. I have my own blog at gaijinzoku.blogspot.com, but in the past I've also written music reviews and film reviews for other fanzines and magazines and whatnot. I thought this would be an interesting topic, one, because this is an activity that both of us do quite often, being film fans. And this is also a topic that many of the audience, so many of our listeners, of course, do as well. I would say most of, listeners out there have their own blogs or their own podcasts, or they write professionally even. I know there are a couple of professional writers out there. And to tell you the truth, recently, and this is the main reason why I chose this topic, recently, as I've mentioned countless times already, I've been very busy, in fact, a little too busy to read books and, you know, play video games and watch movies. So instead, sort of in a semi-vicarious manner, I read reviews about them. And so I've been reading lots and lots of reviews, and these are, of course, as I mentioned, about books, movies, TV, restaurants, video games, you know, all these things that, you know, some of these things I'm not particularly interested in, but I am interested in the process by which people experience something and try to convey it into a review that a lot of times boils down to either a recommendation or something to the quite the opposite.
Opinion.
Right. And of course, an opinion. The opinion is even, you know, to a great degree, even more important than the recommendation or the non-recommendation. So I thought this would be an interesting subject for us to delve into.
Yeah.
So a couple of conversational topics. The first one was, what should a review tell a reader? And the second one is, by what process do you review films? And I thought we'd make this sort of like a tennis match where we could both talk on these topics, Josh.
Yeah.
So why don't we try to challenge the first one, if I may ask you. What do you think a review should tell a reader?
I suppose in the context of film, first thing you have to get out of the way, of course, is, you know, the plot, bare bones, you know, throw that out there. Second, I don't know, when I'm looking for a review, generally I look for someone that can dissect a film and go more into, you know, can go into the technical merits of something, okay. Describe proper framing and how the movie's set up and that sort of thing. That gives me an idea of just how complex or how, you know, simple the film might be, but also, you know, someone who can have fun with it, you know. And that's what I always try to do with my writing, at least, you know, get across the fact that even if a movie's not necessarily complex or well made, it can still be fun. Just, you kind of have to sit there and know your audience, and you have to sit there and write explicitly with them in mind. Generally, I think when it comes to film recommendations, there's a lot of different ways you can go about it. What do you got?
I think, you know, there are many different styles of writing, and not everyone has their own personal style, but to a degree you can say that, you know, your writing style is your own if it can convey how you feel about a particular thing. But in some ways, you know, style is one thing, but I think what really I like to see in a review and what I like to see in writing in general is I like to see writers who can keep things simple. I think, you know, there are lots of, you know, very professional reviewers out there who are very good with words. But, you know, when you look at, let's say, someone like, let's say, Roger Ebert, you know, Roger Ebert to me has, you know, you might not agree exactly with his opinions on movies, but I think his style is just about right for what reviews should be to me. Usually that he'll have a simple little hook in his writing. He'll give it just enough of his own opinion, his own experience with the movie. You know, of course, he's an insider, so he can, you know, give us some insider information about the actors or the staff involved with the film. But I think what it really boils down to is that he can say these things without being too wordy. And being someone who has an interest in writing and whose writing is not particularly all that great, I think it's really says a lot when someone's writing can be exactly how you can imagine how they're feeling without being convoluted, right?
His reviews probably, I mean, he's probably, well, probably about like 600-700 words.
Right, exactly.
You know, at best.
Right. And I think that anyone should be able to write a review of that length. Mm-hmm. And of course, there are many who can do that. But I think it's actually, if you really think about it, very difficult to do. Because, especially in the age of the internet now, where, you know, we can write any number of paragraphs about, you know, if I take my last review off of my blog, that's a move.
Which was well written, might add.
Okay, well, thank you. If I look at that particular review, I could say at least 15% of that could be cut down easily. 15% of the words, that is. I don't think it's particularly wordy, but I think there are some points where the grammar could be a little cleaner and some of the message could be a little more concise. So to me, you know, a review should say everything that you mentioned, you know, should give you basic summary, should give you a good clean opinion, should give you some technical details, etc. But, you know, I would add to that, it should be simple and concise. And that's what I like to see.
Yeah, something I tend to have trouble with myself there. Tonight I was actually finishing up my review for A Snake of June.
All right.
I was writing that tonight, and there I was about my, I think it came out to be like 4 paragraphs worth of review, and then the conclusion at the end or whatever, but had 4 paragraphs, and I was on like the 3rd or 4th paragraph, and I'm like, going over all this stuff about, you know, how Tsukamoto, how each of his films look so completely different and how every movie of his provides something new and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But then I get into that final, the 4th part of my paragraph and I realize I've probably written at this point about 750 words or so. And I'm like, you know, I haven't really mentioned, you know, some of the more memorable parts of this film yet, you know? And then I start going, oh, Christ, I'm going to have to try to shove all this into, you know, the final moment. So, yeah, I get what you're saying with that for sure, and it's something even I need to work on.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, and that's one thing I think it's not stressed enough with people who are interested in writing, at least semi-professionally, is that, you know, writing is a very recursive activity. It's something that you have to do over and over and over again if you want to improve. I'm not too sure how you were taught writing, but for example, my generation, you know, we were just taught to just write and that was it. And we weren't necessarily taught how to edit and how to rewrite or how to, or even sometimes how to think of ideas of how to write, you know, like the old brainstorming, right? So in a way, you know, I kind of hope that people, when they are writing, that they think about, you know, what they want to get down and try to get it down and try to write and then rewrite and rewrite and rewrite until you get it down right, so to speak. And that's kind of a pun, that's sort of a pun intended right there. Okay.
Yes, it is. Yeah, I'm self-taught myself, you know, pretty much. So, you know, basically anything I've learned from reviewing, which is probably like most in the audience, I've learned from reading, you know,
right.
People. And, you know, like Mike Bracken was definitely a heavy influence on me, you know, from thehorrorgeek.com, for those interested, you know, reading his reviews where he takes, you know, stuff like Ilsa She-Wolf of the SS, but he never patronized with his writing, you know? And I've always appreciated that about Bracken. That's another thing that I look for in a review. I'm not, you know, there are a lot of websites that are really entertaining and really fun, B-movie related websites and stuff where basically they'll go over the entire film, you know, and basically just make little quips here and there, like, oh, this happens and that happens, oh my gosh. Which, you know, that is definitely a fun read, but not necessarily something I look for in a person that I might be wanting to read more and more often.
Right.
Know?
Yeah, and I would say that that's probably the right thing to do as far as trying to learn how to write. One thing that writing teachers try to emphasize to students is that, is to emulate. So, you know, as you said, to read other better writers and not necessarily steal their style, but sort of understand what they're doing and understand the mechanics of things and try to adopt those mechanics and make them your own eventually. Well, we're actually kind of going into the second question of the topic. So why don't we do that? Why don't we go into that and talk about by what process do you review films? I mean, from the beginning of actually getting the film into the DVD player to having, you know, what we believe is a finished product. What do you do, Josh?
Used to generally, when I first started writing, if you read some of my first reviews, I would just watch a film and then sit there and kind of let it brew in the mind before going out and actually writing anything up. I actually never took notes I started my website back in 2003. I started writing in about 2002 with it. Probably the first 2 to 3 years I never really, probably the first 3 years I didn't take a note, you know? I would just sit there and kind of freewheel with it. But yeah, over time I've learned that notes really do make the difference, especially if you can type while watching the film.
Right.
whenever I'm sitting watching a film, I like to have the laptop out and set it in the DVD player, take some time out and sit there and watch. And while I'm going, I might have to pause or something like that. But if something catches my attention, something that I feel needs to be addressed, I'll sit there and type it out as I would in a review. I'll sit there and, you know, get almost a full paragraph out sometimes, you know. And then, you know, after watching the film, sometimes if you know, I'll sit there and go back through it, kind of skimming through it, fast forwarding it, just getting different things out of it and things that I might not have picked up. You know, you don't want to sit there and write and be distracted, you know. So sit there and pick up what I can from that and then go back and try to sit there and kind of just piece everything together, you know.
Right.
And generally after that, then I'll sit there and go back through, reread it. I like to also speak it out loud. You know, as long as I have the time, if I'm not, you know, pushed on anything, I sit there and reread the review out loud so that I know it doesn't sound absolutely retarded. And, yeah, that usually helps me. If it doesn't sound good while you're reading it, you know, to a fake audience, then you probably need to go back and edit a few things. Right. What about you?
Well, in my particular opinion, actually, we're kind of opposites. As you you already know, I'm not much of a note taker. I never have been. I'm very much of an auditory person. I learn things through listening and audio, and I'm not very good at writing things down. A lot of times I take notes, and I look at them later, and I kind of think, so what's that supposed to mean? It's like I don't really get the context. I'm actually the kind of person who I'll watch a movie and I'll let it stew in my head for a long time, which is not the best thing to do because, you know, a lot of times you can forget things. And this is one reason why during the reviews on the podcast here, you're the one who's doing the synopsis, because a lot of times I don't remember enough of the synopsis to be able to be concise with it. Unless I actually sit down and expressly want to write down a synopsis. But what I do think about when I'm thinking about a movie is I think a lot about themes. I was a literature major, which, by the way, doesn't get you much of a career. but through that training, I guess, you know, you catch on how to read into things and how to pick up on themes and topics within movies, you know, and even like stupid movies, like, you know, of course, you know, this being a cult film podcast, you know, we're going to run into a lot of, you know, what we call B movies. Yeah. But a lot of those B movies, you know, even though they're stupid and everything, they do have themes in them that are very important. You know, sometimes themes that point back to, you know, older stories. There's that one particular movie, it was a Pamela Anderson movie. Oh, Barbed Wire. if I remember correctly, have you watched Barbed Wire?
God, I probably watched it on, like, Skinamax back in the day or something during my teenage years.
I don't know if you caught the credits on it, but you might have caught that they actually make a reference that it's the story is partially based on Casablanca. Yeah, I know. That's really? The first thing I thought, but if you look into it a little bit, you can sort of see, okay, well, I guess that, you know, this character could have been this character, and this character could have been this character. We can obviously say that, you know, the connection is very weak, if anything, right? But I think a lot of times when we look at B-movies, we just think they're stupid, but there are people who, you know, who a lot of times are talented. They have raw talent. And a lot of people are very well read, et cetera, and they know that there are these themes that they are going to put in their movies. Of course, sometimes these themes involve, you know, rubber monsters or big breasts, you know. But
Hey, Ebert wrote Beyond the Valley of
Dolls. Right, exactly. You know? Yeah, he's a kind of a perfect example of someone who's very well educated, but who's involved in cult film. You know, if you look at John Waters. Yeah, very, I don't know how educated he is, but he's very articulate.
He comes across as
intelligent. Yeah, articulate, very, intelligent sounding person. So, you know, even though we're dealing with these movies that are, you know, on the surface really stupid, I think that, you know, and especially, and this is something that's gonna come out, later in the Tetsuo review, that a lot of these movies, you know, for their time even, you know, there's some context that plays into the theme of a movie that sometimes that, you know, much later on, we can't really catch. And I think that's kind of hard. That's something I try to look into also. You know, I try to, you know, if I'm watching, let's say, a Hercules movies from the 50s, you know, obviously it's just a bunch of greasy muscle men, right? But I think, you know, what I'm looking at that point is, you know, why was this particular movie made at this particular time? You know, in this particular time, maybe there was a trend of Hercules movies, and why was this trend there? So I think that plays a lot into how I read a film, to look into that the time, the trends, etc., in time, to see exactly, you know, what place that film has in history.
I mean, that's something that personally I need to probably focus on more with my writing and stuff. But like on the site now, I'm doing like the trivia thing and all that, and I found that's been kind of pretty, you know, interesting situation to sit there and try to dig up facts on movies and stuff like that, and try to explain background on them while also doing my usual shtick of, you know, going through, you know, cinematography and all that.
Right, I did notice that one addition that you made to your reviews is to put in the trivia from the films. That's kind of interesting. Yeah. Okay, so at this point, let's just leave it to our listeners to respond. So if you want to contact us, again, the voicemail line is 206-338-3864. And our email address is vcinema@variedcelluloid.net. Tell us what you think of this particular topic of movie reviewing. Hope you enjoyed it, and stay tuned for our review of
Dead the Wall!
Hollywood producer Robert Evans. You know, I've made a lot of powerful enemies during my time in Hollywood, like the time I pushed Steve McQueen in front of a moving car on the set of The Getaway because he was macking on my lady, Ally McGraw. But I've made one great friend, a boffo friend, if you will, since I retired. It's called Show Show, and it's the best fucking movie podcast ever. It's even better than cocaine, which I would know a lot about.
Visit ShowShow at showshow.podomatic.com or search ShowShow, all one word, in the iTunes store.
This is Australia calling, and we want you to be infected by our oral luster as we examine a liturgy of the most obsessive and unusual cinema available to mere mortals.
Shut the fuck up, Ben.
What? That's a great promo.
That's a load of wank.
Oh, okay, fine. How about Cinecultania? So awesome, we knock stuff off the table.
That's better. How about we try
Cinecultania, a weekly podcast featuring in-depth discussion on Australian and international cinema. Classic favourites, forgotten gems, total junk. We will dig deep into Australian cinema history for your listening pleasure. Available at cinecultania.blogspot.com or find us on iTunes.
Oh! って続けたもの。
This week, we have a review for Shinya Tsukamoto's 1989 cyberpunk thriller, Tetsuo the Iron Man.
Booyah.
Someone made a comment to me earlier today that, you know, the title Tetsuo the Iron Man is somewhat redundant.
Yeah.
Because Tetsuo actually means Iron Man. But if you think of it, Tetsuo is also a male's name, so it could, you know, it could just follow.
We've all seen Akira.
Just like if we said, like, Josh, the complete idiot. I mean, that's redundant.
I mean,
too.
Yeah, I mean, doesn't make too much sense.
But
I mean,
one is your name and one is what you are, okay?
Oh, anyway.
And of course, we're just teasing.
Sure.
Josh, why don't you give us a little synopsis of the movie?
Okay. Well, Tetsuo is not a film that relies heavily on plot. It starts off with a gentleman known only to the audience as the metal fetishist, because he has a fetish for metal, and he jams a piece of metal into his leg as some kind of sexual thrill, I suppose, and he takes off running into the streets and is struck down by a car. We cut to a Japanese gentleman, a salaryman, who lives a kind of boring life with his spouse when he finds a piece of metal growing out of his flesh. And as he prods and plays with it, it starts to open up and, you know, shoot geysers of blood all over the place, and eventually starts to, you know, spread throughout his body. He tries to hide it from his spouse while she wonders what's going on with him, and basically he's becoming a half-human, half-machine hybrid. As things elaborate, metal fetishist comes back into the picture, and is he dead? Is he a spirit? Who knows? And what kind of control does he have on reality? And that's basically, you know, Tetsuo in a nutshell.
First off, let's talk about why we're actually reviewing this film. Do you remember exactly why?
Yes, I do. Yes,
okay,
I do.
Why don't you tell the wonderful audience then?
Originally, the two of us, we were going to maybe tackle, do like a little dual review, where the two of us were going to go over, you know, this was back in on variedcellular.net. Basically, we were going to do, you know, your thoughts and my thoughts on the same films. Never actually went down, but it was the first film picked was going to be Tetsuo. And I actually did some writing on that, but never came into fruition.
Okay, well, let me just go ahead and talk a little bit about Tetsuo the movie, because Tetsuo was a movie that I saw in the theaters back in 1990. I think it was when it was first released in the U.S. That was a time when I was in high school. First off, let me start off by saying that I chose this movie to review also in addition to the double review format that we were supposed to have over at Varied Celluloid. I chose to review Tetsuo because recently it's been reviewed quite disfavorably in our little community of podcasters and bloggers, etc. And it's somewhat understandable. I mean, Tetsuo does have, and I'm not trying to necessarily go into my review right now, but Tetsuo does have these trademarks of a first-time film from a first-time filmmaker. Actually, Tetsuo was Tsukamoto's maybe about his third film.
Yeah.
And if you go back further, of course, when he was a child, he did his own shorts, etc., with a Super 8. But anyway, so if you look at this at Tetsuo, you can see a lot of the trademarks of the first time or the early filmmaker in that, as you mentioned, Josh, it's quite an abrasive film.
Yes.
It can be very self-consciously artsy and at times a little pretentious. And I would bring out the alert right now, but I don't want to interrupt myself.
Yes. You could do it for the whole review, though, I'm sure.
Yeah,
just
right.
Just talking about the film is going to bring the pretentious alarm out.
Right. So anyway, so it's also a cheap film. You know, the effects are relatively cheap. The costuming and everything is pretty cheap. And I would agree with all these assessments that you can make about it. In fact, you know, Tetsuo, if you think about it, it has a style that for real life film, as opposed to, let's say, animated film, it's a style that can easily be laughed at because it takes itself very seriously at times. Mm-hmm. And I think because of that, you know, when you have things like cheap sets and cheap effects, you know, the first reaction you have is to laugh at it. And, you know, when you think of it, if it's anime and it's over the top, then we can go along with the joke because animation to us is somewhat meant to be funny. Mm-hmm. But real life is meant to be, you know, more realistic. So I think that causes a little bit dissonance in people's minds that you're watching this movie that's, you know, real life actors and it obviously looks really cheap and over the top, so you kind of think, well, is it supposed to be serious or is this supposed to be funny? And I think Tetsuo has those hallmarks of kind of being both. You know, I'm pretty sure that the filmmakers had intentionally made the film to be somewhat humorous, at least, you know, as far as an inside joke goes. Mm-hmm. But anyway, let me go back into history, back into the 1989s when Tetsuo first came out. And at that time, it was actually reviewed quite favorably in its day. It won an award, which actually gave it its international recognition. It was the Best Film Award at the Fanta Festival. When I think about Tetsuo back in the day, I also actually did not like the film very much when I first saw it. And for many of the same reasons that I mentioned, that it was abrasive, it frankly gave me kind of a headache. And it, you know, I think it's only 67 minutes long. And honestly, I felt that it was maybe about 110 minutes at the time. It just felt that way because, you know, you're sort of subjected to it. And, you know, being young at the time, and I was, you know, I guess I was exposed enough to art film at that time, but I just wasn't ready for something so abrasive and in your face. But when I look back at that, I really think that Tetsuo, as far as the modern, you know, and I think this genre has kind of gone out of favor, but the modern Asian extreme film, in quotes, Tetsuo was basically was the progenitor of those particular films. You know, very much so that, you know, you can thank Tetsuo and its breakthrough in the West for all these filmmakers that we like nowadays. For example, Takashi Miike, and Kiyoshi Kurosawa, and, you know, all these great films that we're getting from places like Tokyo Shock and, you know, other such labels. And when you think about it at the same time too, you know, when I think of Tetsuo at that time, it was not only a breakthrough in terms of extreme film, but it was also much a breakthrough in terms of Japanese film. Because I think nowadays, those of us who have just gotten into cult film, like within the past, let's say 10 or 15 years, you know, we sort of have benefited from people who, for example, like, let's use an example, Tarantino, who they know their film and they've dug back into the archives and started re-releasing these items to the West. But back in the 80s, actually, Japanese film had basically all but dried up. Of course, Kurosawa was still around at the time, and he was doing some really great film, like Kagemusha and Ron. As well, for example, Shohei Imamura, he was at its peak, actually, in the late 70s and early 80s. He's a director who did Ballad of Narayama and Black Rain. And Kinji Fukasaku was still around. Seijun Suzuki was doing his trilogy that, I forget, Zugun Wasen trilogy. I forget how it's pronounced exactly. At the time, I think that people had already assumed that Japanese film was one particular way, which was either, you know, the Chambara samurai films, or these very provincial country-like films, these films that portray, you know, the old traditional Japan. So I think that's almost like, I don't want to say a stereotype, but a sort of a niche that the Japanese films had kind of fallen into. And the reason why I hold Tetsuo in such high esteem is because Tetsuo was one of those films that really broke that mold. If you take, for example, Imamura's Ballad of Narayama, and then juxtaposition that with Tetsuo, you know, there's this very big, there's almost like a cavernous gap between those two films. But in terms of what Tetsuo was portraying back then, which was a sort of reaction to the modern society, I think that Tetsuo was somewhat, I guess you could say, a lot more true to what was happening in Japan at that time than something like, you know, Ballad of Narayama, which was, you know, more of, again, a more traditional type of movie. And I would think there was only maybe one Japanese director at the time who was putting out films that had more of this contemporary feel to them, and that was Juzo Itami, who did, for example, Tom Popo and The Funeral. Mm. So, whereas, you know, Juzo Itami could give you a greater feel to what the contemporary Japan was in, I would say, more of that suburban feel of Japan. Tsukamoto, I felt, with Tetsuo really gave you what that urban feel, or that sort of urban blight, the feel of people who had suffered from urban blight, how they felt about the situation. And that'll come out a little bit more in my review a little later. So why don't you go ahead and go into your review first?
Okay. When you're first talking about it, like you said, it's an abrasive film. It's you know, shot entirely in black and white. And it's basically a film of ideas, themes, atmosphere. It's not really anything to do too much. There's not too much logical thought going on in it. So it's essentially just a far out type of watch. You know, when you sit there and first time with it, I think I discovered it through, I don't remember. I think for sure the first time I read, you know, extensively on it was Andrew's review on badmovies.org, I think. You know, I'd sat there and I don't remember if he even gave it a favorable review or anything like that, but I just remember, you know, seeing the images and seeing how, you know, kind of disturbing it looked. You know, I was like, wow, this really looks like something I need to watch. You know, sitting down with it, it's, to me, I don't know, sitting down watching it now, you know, I'm used to it. I've seen it a couple times, and it's probably my third or fourth time sitting through it. I don't know. But it's an easy watch for me. It's just an easy film to sit there and watch and pick apart, you know, what this might mean or what that is, or, you know, after you've seen it and the initial shock's gone, it's just like really full to the brim of like all kinds of little different ideas and stuff. Tsukamoto, you know, wasn't the most polished of filmmaker at the time, but I think that really works for the film.
Well, on that note, you know, I was actually talking to Christopher Jacobson, mm-hmm. you know, on our forums, verycelluloid.net forums. And I actually made the comment to him earlier today that Tetsuo the Iron Man is kind of a one-trick pony, basically. Mm-hmm. But it's a good one-trick pony.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as opposed to, you know, the sequel, let's say.
Yeah, yeah, which I'm sure we'll get to that.
Yeah,
later,
we'll talk
right?
about that. Go ahead, sorry.
No, no, that's fine. A lot of what the effect that Tetsuo has on you, I think, comes from, like, the sound design, as well as the really, you know, harsh, you know, cinematography. But, yeah, Chu, who does the music? I forget his name.
Chu Ishikawa. And, by the way, his music is being played between the segments of the show.
Chu Ishikawa, yeah. He's done the music for a lot of Tsukamoto's work, and he always brings something interesting to the table. But Tetsuo is kind of this strange industrial hardcore sound to it, and then mix that with all the violence and bizarre imagery, and something that stays with you and something that's memorable. But the music, you know, and the sound, you know, there's parts in it where people are, you know, zipping up their jackets, and the jacket is mixed up, you know, higher than dialogue is in most films. It's a harsh, harsh film. One thing that's always stuck with me, and one of my favorite shots from anything from Tsukamoto and all of his films that I've seen, is the, it doesn't open with it, but it's one of the opening shots of the metal fetishist when he takes that pipe and kind of, like, grinds it between his teeth.
Yeah, very grating.
Yes. But that's another instance where the, you know, the sound effects just kind of blow you away. It's just, imagine someone taking a jagged pipe-like metal object and running it over their teeth in, like, extreme close-up.
Yeah, very much. It's almost like the effect of, you know, like nails on a chalkboard. Right?
But even worse. Yeah. It's really, really hardcore. From there, I think in the beginning, there's a lot. It's a very visual film, very interesting. Another thing that you can actually see in the trailer that was played earlier, if you watch it, it's Tomorrow Taguchi doing his spasmodic dancing while Tetsuo begins to glide over the screen, kind of like Rocky.
Right, and we have a return appearance by Tomorrow Taguchi.
Yes.
He's going to be like our mascot, the V-Cinema mascot.
He is, man. We might even do one of his directorial films later on.
Right. I looked up a little bit on Tomorrow Taguchi because we had talked about him during the episode in which we did Miike's Shinjuku Triad Society. Mm-hmm. Actually, he started off with Tsukamoto. They knew each other in college, apparently, and they were in a theater group that they had formed by themselves. And it's kind of interesting because now that I think about it, if you look at Tomorrow Taguchi's work as far as his acting goes, as well as Tsukamoto's, they are very theatrically influenced.
Oh, yes.
With the, you know, the facial movements, etc.
Mm-hmm. He's a slightly more like over the top, maybe Gary Oldman kind of, like, in the fact that he, you know, every role he does, he's so drastically different.
Yeah, that's a fair comparison.
Yeah, here in Tetsuo, really, I mean, watching it again, he looks so different. I know he's young. But, I mean, he just looks so different here, you know, just with the slick black hair and the suit, as opposed to all of his later films where he's either psychotic or like a man boy or bleach blonde dye job going on. You know, just he's always looks different. And Tetsuo, he's very, you know, like I described in early, spasmodic. He's all over the place, making lots of funny kabuki theater style faces and stuff at the camera. Yeah, very interesting. Also in the cast, you have like Nobu Kanoka. I don't know how to pronounce her name.
Yeah,
but
Nobu,
yes.
Kanoka. Yeah.
Yeah, she has a small role in the lady who assaults and chases Tomorrow while he's at the bus station, I believe it is, or
right.
Maybe a subway. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But anyway, yeah, she doesn't. I'm sure she has some kind of history with Tsukamoto as well, but she is probably one of the most strange and disturbing looking females in any film ever, especially as she becomes zombified,
right,
mixed with machinery and stuff. There's in a possible dream sequence or something like that in the midst of the film.
Right. I think why is because she kind of has somewhat extreme features.
Yes.
And, yeah, she's
eyes.
And she's very much of a thin lady too, so yeah, that makes for sort of like, I don't mean to insult her if she's listening, but almost, she kind of reminded me a little of almost like a scarecrow or something.
Yeah. I'm not saying she's not an attractive lady. But anyway, you also have Kei Fujiwara, also a Tsukamoto. I'm not sure what their past is together, but she took over the cinematography duties.
Right. She was in the same theater group as Tomohiro Taguchi and Tsukamoto.
She's also went on to do some directorial stuff as well. She's done Oregon. I haven't seen her latest film. I forget the title of it, but I'm really interested in it.
It's Id.
Id?
Yeah. Or in Japanese, it's pronounced Ido. So, Ido. Yeah, it's, yeah. I've seen it. It's, Oregon is much better.
Really?
Yeah, Id was, Oregon, Id I really was like a little actually. Ridiculous.
Yeah, Oregon I'm actually kind of a big fan of. I thought that was very Tsukamoto-ish, you know.
Yeah, right.
Very much in his vein. However, it's a less of a fear of man-made things as it is a fear of biological
right.
type of things. I mean, it's a lot of green and a lot of blood and gore. It's pretty disgusting, but it's also pretty amazing.
So did you happen to check out the one cameo in the movie?
What was that?
Oh, okay. It was Renji Ishibashi, who...
Oh, wait. What was he doing in it? I think I recall seeing him.
He plays the hobo at the very end.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes. I thought I recognized it. I was gonna ask you about that, if that was him.
Yeah. And just so everyone knows, Renji Ishibashi is he's an actor, of course, who has been in film since the early 70s. He's been in movies such as, he's been in one of the Hanzo the Razors. He was in a couple of the Lone Wolf and Cub movies. A more modern film that people would know him in was, he was in Audition. He played the old, scary old man in the wheelchair. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's him. So apparently, Tsukamoto was able to get his services for, I think it was like 2 or 3 days or something. I guess he gave, Tsukamoto that is, gave the script to Ishibashi and he sounded interested. Ishibashi's always been kind of an interesting character. He's taken like a lot of like smaller roles just so he could, get in on someone's, you know, vision. So yeah. he's very supportive type of, character actor, I'd say, yeah, in Japan.
It's very awesome of him.
Yeah.
There are a lot of different ways that you can take the film. There's, you know, you can sit there and watch it as just a piece of pure entertainment, which I believe that it is. It's not exactly, you know, it's never a dull film. You know, it's not like your average art house thing where we're not talking about, you know, Tarkovsky, you know, Andrei Tarkovsky or anything like that. We're talking about pretty insane stuff. You know, there's a blistering pace to it. And I think it's easy to take it that way where you can sit there and watch it and say, you know, okay, you know, there's a lot of stuff. Wow, they're doing stop motion now, and there's a big chase scene, and, you know, there's violence. You can watch it as that, but I think there's also a lot of fun in looking at it from different perspectives. I've looked up various interpretations of it, and I think that you can pretty much take it any way that you want. You can look at it as, you know, the one thing that doesn't change, I don't think, in any way you look at it, is man's plight with technology and, you know, industrialization and stuff like that. It's just man dealing with what he has created. And I think that is a strong theme throughout a lot of Tsukamoto's career. And that's why I think, you know, I have read people who believe that there's nothing really going on in Tetsuo on a deeper level, you know, that it's just a exercise and creativity and making something that is different, but I believe it's very much an influence even to this day on Tsukamoto's career, and that's probably why he's making a third one. But, yeah, you can look at it as...
Wow, that was amazing, and yeah. I want to gouge out my eyes.
Doesn't that basically sum up what you think?
Yes, that is it. I think you can look at Tetsuo as being... There's a theme to it that, I mean, you could look at it as maybe even a film about repressed homosexuality between, you know, the character of the salaryman and the metal fetishist. Or you could look at it as a film about relationships, the way things go down between the character of the salaryman and his wife or girlfriend, whatever she is. I don't think it ever actually explains it. And man's difficulty to retain his humanity in the face of our society becoming so technologically advanced. You know, I think you can look at it that way and have like scenes like where, you know, the salaryman has a dream where his wife wears I don't know how to describe it in friendly terms, a a guided dildo type snake monster from her pelvis and basically, yeah, molests her husband. You can look at that in a lot of different ways, you know. I mean, it's obviously pretty interesting, you know, visually, but it's also, there's a fear of sexuality, a fear of womanhood maybe, or, you know, it could tie into the theme of homosexuality and the famous last lines of the film, which are, what is it, with our love we can take on this whole fucking world, I think.
I think he says our love can destroy this fucking world.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, something like that. But I'm not going into the exact meanings of that, but yeah, that line could be interpreted in a lot of different ways, but that's kind of the whole thing about Tetsuo. It can be looked at from a lot of different perspectives, and I think that's part of the fun of it, part of that, you know.
I'm sorry, I had to break that out on you.
Actually, you should have used that a while back. But yes, yes. It's a film that'll bring it out in you. It'll bring out the pretentious alarm. Visually, you know, if you're sitting at home, if you've never seen anything from Tsukamoto and you have no idea what Tetsuo is about, I guess it's warranted. I mean, but everybody brings it up, and I hate to be another one of those guys that has to bring up, you know, David Lynch and David Cronenberg, but yeah, there's definitely some of that in Tsukamoto's work, and there's definitely a lot of that in Tetsuo. There's a lot of body modification, body horror type stuff going on. So there's Cronenberg. And then, you know, pretty much anything that's weird that's shot out there automatically gets labeled as Lynchian. So, but yeah, imagine that on black and white photography and very, very abrasive and to the extreme. But yeah, that's pretty much it. Do you have some thoughts?
Well, as I mentioned, when I first saw the movie back in the 90s, I do have to admit again that I was actually kind of displeased with the movie. It took me a little time to really get what was going on with the film. And I think, as you mentioned, there are two interpretations of the film that you take, and I think you're basically talking more about the second interpretation, which is it being sort of a sexual or fetishist orientated movie. I'm sure just like me that you've done your research on the movie by reading the Iron Man book from Tom Mess, right?
I have not, but I want to.
Okay. Well, yeah, I actually read the book, and Tsukamoto does mention that he was trying to bring out those sort of themes. But I think, you know, taking the former theme or the first theme that you mentioned, I think actually fits in very well with it as far as its historical context. And that theme that you brought out was, you know, man versus society and technology, right? So sort of this three-way battle. And I think that's the interpretation that I've always kind of stuck with. Because there are a few things in the movie that sort of point to that. Is in the very intro, you might remember of the movie, there's a sort of intro card that gives you the name of the movie, of course, and then it says, and I don't remember the exact Japanese, but I remember it's something like Futsu no Kaiju Shirizu, and Futsu just means normal, but the word kaiju is a word that comes up a lot in film circles that means, it actually literally means great beast, if I remember the kanji correctly. And when we say kaiju, we're always pointing to the movies like, for example, Godzilla and Mothra. Those gigantic monster movies, basically. Mm-hmm. And the theme of most of those is related to either the nuclear age or the atomic age, how, you know, man has basically overstepped his boundaries, and that by doing that has caused his or her own self-destruction. And I think I read Tetsuo as being that, but taking away the atomic age allegory and putting in the technological age allegory. And the reason why I say that is because if you think about it, let's see, World War II ended in, what was it, 45, thank you. And let's see, the modernization, the rebuilding and modernization of Japan took how long? Approximately 25 years, maybe even less than that. That's actually a very short amount of time to go from being a country basically in ruins to one in which, you know, with skyscrapers and with, you know, technology and a more consumer-driven society. And I always have the feeling that, and I believe that's Einstein's theory about for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. So, you know, with this new modernization of Japan, you have a situation where, like, for example, you're holding a rubber band, and if you pull it one direction, you have to expect that it's going to snap back in the other direction. And I think Tetsuo is, at least my interpretation of Tetsuo, is that it's trying to tell us that, you know, we've pulled the society so far, and our reward, or our punishment, I guess you could say, is that technology is going to eventually take us over. And I'm glad actually you brought up that last line, our love can destroy this fucking world. Because I think you see it as being, or you sort of mention it as being part of this sort of, again, the sexual theme to it.
Yeah, it's possible. There, like I said, there's a lot of different interpretations of what you can make out
right.
of that.
Right. And I think if you put that into the theme of technology, though, you can almost see it as being man creating technology and together them destroying the world. Because, you know, another reason why I bring up this theme is because within the movie, there are a lot of times where you have characters who are interacting with each other in very cold and distant ways. The movie actually opens up with a sequence in which the man is talking to his girlfriend or his wife. I don't remember exactly who she's supposed to be.
I don't know if that.
But they keep they're talking on the telephone. They keep repeating back and forth. Hello,
yes.
Hello, hello.
Machine
right,
machine.
Exactly. And that's actually someone made a comment to me earlier that's how they learned how to say moshi moshi was to Tetsuo, which is kind of funny. But you almost have that feeling, and later on in a few other scenes where you have characters who are looking at each other from the viewer's perspective, it looks like that you are looking into a TV screen, which is looking into another character's eyes, which gives you that kind of cold and distant feeling that technology is part of what's standing between us as humans. And, you know, Tokyo House is 20% of Japan's population, which is extremely, extremely dense, right? That's a dense population for such a small area. And yet, you can really feel sometimes that, I mean, I'm sure you've seen pictures of, you know, the Tokyo subways are all jammed packed with people.
Oh, yeah.
And the Tokyo streets, you're always kind of dodging people and trying to move out of the way. You have that feeling sometimes that you really are alone, because it's a lot of times, and I'm not trying to just only say Japanese society, but I think also here in the U.S., we have those times in which, you know, we're in these big cities and we're surrounded by technology, surrounded by people, etc. And yet, a lot of times, we don't know how to communicate with each other. You know, I'm not too sure if you caught the very end. There's an ending card that's very easy to miss if you don't watch all the credits, but it flashes game over, right?
Game over,
which is kind of also sort of I thought kind of supported that theme of, you know, technology. You know, have we started looking at life as just a video game now, or is it something that we should be you know, living and enjoying, right?
Yeah.
With that said, you know, I would say that Tetsuo is a postmodern kaiju film.
Mm-hmm.
So it's definitely part of the kaiju tradition of, you know, having the theme of something greater than us taking us over. You know, our own creation taking us over, like almost like a Frankenstein sort of mythology. You know?
Yeah. It's in there with it, for sure. Yeah.
So anyway, let's see, my last notes. Let's see, did you want to mention Tetsuo 2 at this point? I mean, have you seen Tetsuo 2?
Yes.
But what about art?
It's not about art. It's about sequel.
That's exactly right, too. I don't know. Tetsuo 2 is not, like, I don't know, it's so horrible, like, but it, yeah, it's definitely a major step down from the majority of Tsukamoto's, you know, films and career. It's been forever since I last saw it, but I just remember being tremendously bored with it.
Mm-hmm.
What about you?
Actually, I rewatched it today, you know, just for the heck of it, just to sort of get a feel for, what it was like, because like you, I hadn't seen it for a while. And, I was really surprised at how dated it looks.
Yeah.
For those of you who don't know, Tetsuo 2 is filmed in color, whereas Tetsuo 1 was filmed in black and white. And the black and white, you know, the black and white is used to great effect, you know, for the stark imagery and the contrast, etc. The Tetsuo 2, it has these washed out colors. I mean, color-wise, they're very interesting. There's a lot of blues and reds and oranges. But they're very washed out and very...
it's like a cruddy VHS.
Yeah, exactly,
tape,
exactly. You know? That's what I was thinking. I was thinking it looks almost like true early 90s V-cinema, which is, for those of you who hadn't caught the explanation earlier, that V-cinema is what the Japanese call direct-to-video. That's their direct-to-video industry, V-cinema. Mm-hmm. So anyways, it has these washed out colors, and you know, I was watching, you know, there's some scenes where it shows them inside like a factory, and there's these like bald guys that are all kind of working out. I was kind of laughing that that particular part of the movie kind of looked like a CNC music factory video. You know, I just, you know, oh, I'm not going to sing or anything. Josh, please.
Oh,
please.
Do it.
Josh,
do it.
Please do it for us.
that's all right. I might sing later.
But what I do appreciate about Tetsuo 2, though, and also Tetsuo 3 by extension, even though I haven't seen it, and incidentally, to me, it doesn't really look that great. But what I do appreciate about these two sequels is that Tsukamoto does look like he wants to continue a sort of Tetsuo mythology, in that, you know, these worlds feel very self-contained, very separate from, well, I guess his other movies as well as the real world. So I thought that was, I think that's kind of cool that he's trying to do that. I'm not sure if he's succeeding, though.
I don't know. Tetsuo Bullet Man, it might be all right, though. I mean, not according to anybody's words so far.
But... yeah, I mean, I'll still watch it and everything, but yeah. I don't have high expectations for it. Which might be a good thing. Who knows, you know. So, Josh, buy, rent, forget it? What do you think?
Buy it,
he says. Okay.
Absolutely. I mean, it's definitely the kind of movie that, you know, it's going to be abrasive to some people. It's going to be hard on, you know, the eyes. But I think, you know, if you watch it and you watch it with an open mind, there's a lot that you can gain from it. You know, just even from just the pure visual aesthetic of it, I think it's a classic that has to be kind of seen, you know, whether or not you love it as much as I do. I think, you know, to really, you know, understand a lot of what you see and...
Wow, that was amazing. And
yeah.
I want to gouge out my eyes.
I agree. Buy it.
Except.
Yes.
Yes.
And actually, while we're at it, it is out still on Tartan Asian Extreme. We have the block coming up next, so let's take a quick break. We'll see you guys in just a couple.
What's up, everybody? This is Bill.
And this is Chris.
From Outside the Cinema. We're here to give you the reasons why you should be listening to Outside the Cinema. One, we cover kick-ass movies.
Two, we cover kick-ass movies.
Okay, this isn't going to work if you continue this way.
Oh, really? I'm not supposed to echo what you say?
Three, I'm good-looking.
Four, I would agree with that.
And five, your life pretty much depends on it.
This is Kane Hodder. Keep listening to Outside the Cinema, or I'll kill you.
OutsideTheCinema.com. It's on the fucking internet.
Outside the Cinema, your source for cult movie discussion.
Tear your soul apart.
Some people lose their faith because heaven shows them too little. But how many people lose their faith because heaven shows them too much?
You'll never grow old, Michael. And you'll never die. But you must be.
Clatu Verata.
Maybe daily kicking the balls or something.
Hey,
like
that's
that.
Cool, man.
So
holy damn, but I've got gingivitis.
It's kind of like a vampire boner.
I would kill to be a tight leather suit.
Everything you've ever learned about freestyle orifice probing, you learned from me.
Oh, this definitely gets an all-time.
For more information, visit cadaverlab.com or search for us on iTunes.
You know what's up next, Josh?
Let me take a guess.
The Block!
Hey, go away!
Oh, yeah! Kool-Aid here, bringing you fun. Kool-Aid got thirst on the run. Get a big, wide, happy beer.
The more Kool-Aid, my smile.
Tastes great. Our scent's cool. Our scent's Kool-Aid. Kool-Aid has optic mix.
Oh, yeah!
Copyright 2000. I told you that I was going to get the Kool-Aid music for this particular segment. So yes, this is the Block. The Block is—it's a block, quite literally. No, the Block is three segments that we smash together into one. We have the Netflix Instant Watch, in which we're going to recommend something off of our Netflix Instant Cues Show and Tell, in which we give the audience a little recommendation of something—a website, a book. A t-shirt, dirty underwear, something that, yes. That we can recommend to them, outside of just a movie. And then, we had a Twitter question, which we put out, and, the question this episode was, what movie do you consider a postmodern masterpiece? And I'm pretty sure this, got a lot of funny, questions from all over the place. Why don't we start off with the Instant Watch? What do you got first, Josh?
Went with kind of, a more mainstream, popular, pick. I mean, I guess you can call it mainstream. It's mainstream for cult film fans, I suppose, but it's a recent film. It's Chocolate, the Thai action film.
Right.
Yeah, it's kind of popular, especially in the past couple of years. It has been. It's from the director of Ong Bak and The Protector, and it focuses on a young autistic woman who seeks out gangsters who are extorting her dying mother. Yeah, it's basically just really, really kick-ass. That's about all you need to know. Truth be told, some people don't seem to dig it because it has like a middle part that kind of sags a little bit. But I think it's a stronger film even than The Protector was, and probably one of my favorite action films of the past, you know, several years. There's lots of splits, kicks, people jumping around, doing all kinds of crazy stunts a la mid-80s Jackie Chan.
Right.
But yeah, awesome stuff.
Hey, by the way, do you know Jackie Chan has a restaurant in Japan? He has a restaurant chain.
I did not know that.
Yeah, it's
I know he sings.
Pretty mediocre Chinese food.
You've actually been there?
Hey, yes.
What?
Yes, there was one about a couple miles from my house. So anyway, back to the Netflix Instant Watch. My recommendation this episode is a movie from a director called Yoji Yamada. Mm-hmm. And, the movie's called Kabe, also known as Our Mother. Yoji Yamada is one of the living legends as far as the Japanese directors are concerned. He was a contemporary of Kurosawa, Ozu, etc. In the Tetsuo review, I mentioned that Japan is sort of known for these kind of provincial dramas. Actually, this movie isn't set in the countryside. It's actually set in Tokyo, but this is kind of an older Tokyo, of course, you know, before there were skyscrapers basically everywhere. And it's a story about a family whose father figure gets imprisoned because he's a communist. He's been basically spreading communist propaganda. North Americans will know sort of the history of discrimination against communism and communists in general. And in Japan, it was also very much alive during the World War II. The father figure gets imprisoned, and the mother has to figure out a way to keep the family unit going. They have two daughters, younger daughters, who, you know, are just learning about the world. You know, they're in the, I believe they're elementary school children. What happens basically then is that there's a protege of the father figure. He's actually played by Tadanobu Asano in a really interesting role. He's kind of plays this kind of nerdy, comedic sort of role. But really? he plays it very well. At first, you know, when he first appears in the movie, he's kind of appears in sort of a one of those nudge nudge wink wink types of moments where it's like, oh, that's him. But he plays out the role very well, and all the performances are very excellent. And I'm really sad that this was a 2008 movie that it didn't get any kind of nod for Academy Award for maybe best foreign film. There wasn't a Japanese representative that year, and I think that Yamada's film could have been in there, I think, with all the other ones. Maybe not have won, but it's very strong. One more thing about Yamada is that this is probably the first movie he's gotten very much he also directed Twilight Samurai, if I remember correctly, mm-hmm. which got some attention a few years ago. But it's kind of sad because he's been around, like I said, for about at least 50, 60 years. He's very famous in Japan for a particular series.
Yes, I was going to mention that. I looked him up on IMDb, and there's like, what's the name of the series?
The Japanese title is Otoko wa Tsurai yo, if I remember correctly, which in English translates to It's Tough Being a Man, which is it's kind of a funny series. It's based
Is it the one with like 50 or 60 different sequels?
Right, exactly.
God, yeah.
Directed all of those. And it's also sort of known as the Torasan yes. series. So some people who are into older Japanese film will probably know that particular name. But anyways, he's very well known in Japan, but very little known here in the U.S.
Yeah.
But you can go check out Kabe on Netflix Instant Watch, and I'll spell it out for you. It's spelled K-A-B-E-I. Very touching, sweet movie, and, you know, at the same time, sad.
Nice.
Yeah. Anyway, so let's move on. We got show and tell. What do you got for us? What are you going to show and tell us, Joe?
I'm picking another website, probably what I'll always pick, but I'm picking 10kbullets.com, 10,000 bullets. Friend of Varied Celluloid, Michael, he runs the website, and it's a film and DVD review website, and they've really done well over the years. And
Wait a second here. He's a friend of Varied Celluloid?
Yes.
Is this some kind of payola situation?
Whoa.
Just kidding. Just go on. Okay.
Yeah, not saying anything, man.
Very good website.
Yeah, 10K Bullets. Visit it. Click on every link. But anyway, they're a really cool website. And right now on their website, I think they still have Love Exposure on there. So, you know, Love Exposure and, you know, lots of pinky violence and stuff like that. So they cover a lot of, you know, Asian cinema and just really cool stuff. So big time, 10kbullets.com.
And is that the number 10?
That is the 10, yes, 10K, yes, sir.
Okay. Well, my item for show and tell is actually a book. Wow.
Whoa.
It's our first time.
What?
These books we read and stuff.
Wait, what do you do with those now?
You actually put them under table legs, you know, when they're kind of...
Okay.
Those
You got
it, Josh?
I got one underneath. Yeah, it's underneath my chair right
now.
Okay,
very good, Josh. Okay.
Okay.
It's probably the Bible or something like that.
Oh, no.
Anyways, the book I'm recommending this time is called Shutting Out the Sun, How Japan mm-hmm. Created Its Own Lost Generation. The author is Michael Zeilenziger. I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly. But this is kind of to go along with the theme of Tetsuo, as I was mentioning earlier, about how the Japanese society has modernized at such a great pace that there are those who have been left behind by that and who have felt disenfranchised in the world. This is basically a documentary of what they're what's called the, in Japanese, the hikikomori, which are these people who have withdrawn from society completely. They're guessing it's some kind of psychological condition, but basically these people they won't go to work or school, and they won't even leave their house, and sometimes they won't even leave their bedrooms. So their parents have to end up taking care of them. So it's a very, very interesting book, very sad book, of course, because it talks about, you know, again, these people who feel disenfranchised by society and life. But, it's at the same time very interesting because it can really tell you again how that, you know, when you pull that rubber band back, you know, how that whiplash effect can occur when you let it go. And, you know, these are the results. Again, these hikikomori, I guess you can translate that into English as withdrawn people. So I recommend it. It gets a little sensational at times because, you know, as the case is with a lot of books, when you read about a book that's documenting a particular condition, you sort of start feeling like, not everyone in society is like that. Come on, you know.
Yeah.
So you have to sort of remember to put in perspective and sort of say like, okay, this is this small percentage of people who have, developed this condition, I guess you could call it. And, but it's, again, very interesting. Check it out. It's called Shutting Out the Sun by Michael Zeilenziger. He's gonna kill me if he ever meets me, you know.
God.
So, you're that V Cinema guy.
Oh yeah, man.
Can't even pronounce Zeilenziger.
Trying to promote my book and you can't get my name right.
Okay. Yes. Now to the Twitter question. Our Twitter question again this episode was, what movie do you consider a postmodern masterpiece and why? Josh, can you define postmodern for us?
Oh man. Let me see if I got a link here or something like that.
Okay, while you're doing that, I will explain it.
Okay, go for it. Your explanation of it.
Actually, this question was somewhat of a trick question. The reason being is because postmodern really can refer to any number of things, any number of philosophies and approaches to certain things. And I'm pretty sure that you must have gotten people who asked you, what does postmodern mean or what?
Yeah, everybody.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that makes sense, you know, because it's not something that we would use in everyday conversation.
Yeah.
And as I mentioned earlier, that I consider Tetsuo somewhat of a postmodern masterpiece, and at the very least a postmodern kaiju film. But what I was kind of getting at was postmodern in terms of film is usually something that goes against the norms as far as narrative structure, mm-hmm. as far as, you know, how the movie plays out, and it plays with these concepts of what, you know, for example, narrative is. So, you know, any number of answers could really be gotten from this particular question, but let me go into what I got from some people on my Twitter account. By the way, my Twitter account is at @VCinemaShow. What's yours again, Josh?
At @VariedCelluloid, and that's right. All lowercase.
Right. So if you aren't following one or either of us already and you want to participate in the Twitter question, follow one or even both of us and
both. Hello.
Yeah. So the first of our replies comes from Bjornar. And let me play some of his theme music first. So our man Bjornar, he said Shaun of the Dead for its utter love of its own genre and combining great horror with genius comedy.
Very nice.
Yeah, and then Dissolved Pet, who is Ben at the Cinecultania podcast, those jerks, he replied, Either Tarantino's Death Proof or Jodorowsky's Santa Sangre could be my favorite postmodern work. Of course, he doesn't give a reason. That figures, not even listening or reading.
Bad.
And the final reply I have is from Loki315. And, he had a request that I have to fill here. He wanted to make sure that we had a particular sound bite for this segment so we could sort of absolve ourselves from all blame. Just a second. So anyway, so Loki315 gave his reply, and he said A Clockwork Orange due to its examination of violence and free will. So what do you got, Josh? Or why don't you share first what your answer is to this intelligent question?
Oh, man, it's too smart for me. I can't figure it out. But I think I chose Once Upon a Time in the West.
Oh, interesting.
I think, Once Upon a Time in the West. Not really what you first might think of when you think of postmodern, but, you know, there's a lot of pastiche going on in it, and I think the way the film itself directly relates to reality and the situation that was going on with Leone at the time, where at the time I believe they thought it was going to be his last Western, and then the film itself is about the end of the West, basically, and man's conflict with technology, similar to the film we have today, kind of fits into that mold, I think. That'd be my choice. You want to go over yours?
In addition to being a real kick-ass movie.
Just, you got it. Yep. Big time.
Oh, mine was Tetsuo. I kind of cheated.
You want to go over 45 more minutes of it real quick? Yeah.
Sure. So anyway, it's a kaiju film.
Bring that back up. Okay, I'll go with what I got here. I got from Rachel's Media. It's Rachel from Australia. She chose Memento. Love the justification for the reverse timeline. Love the twist. Love the questions it asks you. I want to watch it now, she says. Then we got one from Mr. Miles, the man from Show Show.
Oh, Miles.
He says, yeah, he went with the high road. He said, the postman, obviously. I assume he's, yeah, well, I know he is. I asked him about it. The Costner picture.
Yeah, I've seen it.
Yeah, classic.
Yep.
Brilliant.
Yep. I've heard the book is quite good, too. I've been trying to look for it, but my local library doesn't seem to have it, unfortunately.
We got Deadly Dolls. She said that's Emily from deadlydollshouse.blogspot.com. She said irreversible, because as much as people mostly focus on the rape, the backwards timeline makes the film equally effective and sad.
Right. Yeah, that's a great example, actually, of a postmodern movie with that kind of theme of playing with, Memento too. Time. Yeah, playing with time and the effects of events, their connection, etc.
Almost everything has hints of postmodernism these days, but, you know, right. That film definitely, you'd say, the whole film hinges on it, kind of.
Right, yeah. As you said, there are plenty of examples of postmodern films. You even think of things mainstream and well-known things like Scream.
Back to the Future.
Scream, yeah, Back to the Future, yeah, definitely. Pulp Fiction. Those are all movies that, you know, could easily be considered postmodern films. So anyway, so that's the end of our Twitter question. We want to thank everyone for participating. And again, if you want to participate in the next episodes, just follow one of us. I'm at The Cinema Show.
And I am at Varied Celluloid.
I swear one of these days I'm going to end up saying, like, at Vinny's Show. Hey, it's a Vinny's Show, you know?
Hey, Vinny's Show, what's going on?
How you doing? Okay, anyway, so our next segment, we're going to go into show feedback, so stay tuned until then, and see you in a bit.
Call me T-I-R-L girl.
Hello, and welcome back to the feedback section of V-Cinema. But first, we've got us a late entry into the Twitter questions. Our good friend Christopher, known as Christopher Swank on Twitter, he replied with, I still don't know what the hell that is, talking about postmodern cinema, but I'll say Blade Runner, since it's my favorite film, followed by RoboCop, since it's probably my second favorite film, and it's also on that list. Talking about a list of films that I had given him featuring postmodern examples.
That boy needs to do his homework.
I tried to get him, but man, Chris, I'm looking at you, bro. I'm looking at you.
Okay, so let's move on to the feedback, by the way, okay?
I'm looking
and,
at you.
And speaking of which, we got our first voicemail feedback.
What?
Yes, oh, audio feedback excited. Virgins. Yeah. Pop out, Jerry.
Hey, John and Josh, it's Miles from something. I'm not going to say what. I'm not into plugging my shite. Anyway, great show, first of all. I really enjoyed the first episode. I am about halfway through the second episode when you guys got onto the discussion of what a cult movie is and why we like the cult movies that we like, or why we like cult cinema in general. And I want to say, excellent point about the genre thing, because every film belongs to a certain genre, whether it's romantic comedy, western, horror, sci-fi, whatever. It's all a genre, except for the stuff that we can't really classify, like maybe a Jim Jarmusch movie, which is kind of this weird ethereal sort of experience. But anyway, and that's sort of a cult unto itself. But yeah, I think you guys kind of hit it on the head. I think it was John that said it. It's a lot of it has to do with feeling like you're part of something that is special, that's outside of the mainstream. I know that I would agree too that a lot of the people that probably enjoy cult film probably listen to music that is not necessarily considered mainstream. They're not listening to the top 40 stations, and yeah. So that's one of the big reasons why I got into it. And you know, I'm a horror junkie anyway. So finding the next new, like, horror film that nobody else has heard of was really appealing to me, especially in high school. I guess it was a way to differentiate myself from everybody else. And, yeah, I think that carries on to a certain degree into my now adulthood. So, yeah, excellent show. Keep up the good work. I'll talk to you later. Bye.
And that was a little voicemail from our friend Miles over at Show. Yes. Thanks a lot for calling us, Miles. You were the first one to pop our cherries. Yes.
Oh, sexy.
And it felt so good.
Man, I wish we'd get some pepper on this. Some pepper and Todd. All right. Little Show thing. By the way, Show, even though he's not going to hype it, Show, you can find it at showshow.podomatic.com and showshow.libsyn.com.
Sounds good. So is there anything that you want to reply on about his voice message?
I don't know. What were you talking about earlier about you had a friend or something like that you was talking to via Twitter?
I'm not much for the follow Friday trend on Twitter, but
it's too hard.
Yeah, I always try to check out people who other people recommend to follow. I don't actually post follow Fridays myself. So a friend of our show sent out a follow Friday, and I checked out a number of these accounts that he had sent, and I decided to follow a few of them. And then one person I noticed was in the Bay Area, where I live. She had said that she was a big movie fan, and so since we have plenty of festivals in our area, luckily, I decided to chat her up and just ask her, you know, if she went to any particular festivals or what she was looking forward to checking out. It got to be that we've been talking and stuff for the past couple days, primarily about movies. She's not much of a cult movie fan, but I mean, she checked out our podcast, which was really nice. That's something you would not necessarily expect out of someone right away. But we've been talking about mainly Japanese cinema. I was just thinking back to what Miles was saying and back to our discussion last episode, is that it's kind of nice that the cult community, and you know, by using the word cult, it means a group that follows a particular interest or a particular, I guess in this case, movie or genre of movies, etc., that this cult can be so tight-knit where some people I mean, you know, a lot of us came from, a lot of us listeners here are from, we know each other from other podcasts and from other blogs and, of course, being together on Twitter and everything. And it's kind of really interesting how we can just easily throw down all the weight of small talk and simple conversation, yeah, and just be able to talk about what we like without fear necessarily of being judged, which to me I think is really the great thing about being in cult film or, you know, any particular kind of, as we mentioned, music or whatever, is that we can, mm-hmm, you know, as they say, be ourselves. So anyway, let's go to our emails. Did you want to read first, Josh?
Nah, you can go ahead, okay, first.
Well, this first email is from a first-time writer. Well, everyone's a first-time, actually, but this person's name is Chris, and he has his own blog. It's at uncoolcat.blogspot.com. And let me read his message. He says, "Hey, guys, great job with the podcast so far. If I understand correctly, and I'm easily confused," that's Chris is easily confused. I'm not easily confused. "You plan on focusing on Asian cult and genre flicks, which is something I've been waiting for. You're 2 for 2 with positive reviews of Story of Ricky and Shinjuku Triad Society. I was really surprised with Shinjuku Triad Society. I really hadn't heard much about the film when I bought the Miike Omnibus box set and was blown away when I watched it. I love the gritty feel of the film that felt like it was made by an upstart new director. True, Miike's later films are more polished, but I love unpolished just as much and sometimes more than a spick-and-span film. I was shocked to find out that there are people out there who don't like Tetsuo. I remember back in college days when some friends and I rented it, we were all taken aback by its original and exciting film. It's also interesting how Tsukamoto has evolved as a director since making it. He's truly one of the most unpredictable and visionary directors working today. Maybe I'm an old man, but when Tetsuo was released, it really was groundbreaking, and I believe it has no trouble keeping up today, holding up today, excuse me. Kids these days." Yeah, that's what I think. "Looking forward to your hopefully positive review. Keep up the good work, Chris." Well, first off, Chris, thanks for writing in. We appreciate that. Yes. It's always nice to hear from people who, well, one thing we've never heard of, but people who can expose us to new things. About the 2 for 2 for positive reviews, actually, Josh and I were just talking about this just a week ago. And we were basically saying that it was not really in our best interest necessarily to always pick films that we liked. And it just so happened that we both liked Tetsuo this week. So, you know, rest assured that we will be choosing some more unpredictable flicks that neither of us has seen, so we can give very honest reviews about these things. To tell you the truth, Story of Ricky and Tetsuo both had some history between both of us as far as us wanting to include them in Varied Celluloid and also with the V-Cinema webcast. So those were sort of more like nostalgic picks. So, you know, rest assured that we are going to go into different territories and not always review stuff that we've seen and already have clear opinions about.
But we'll try to keep up with, like, the, you know, some of the stuff that people might be slightly more familiar with as well.
Sure.
You know, just to kind of, you know, keep things kind of on balance.
Of course,
you know?
Oh, and then also, just so you know, our next episode, in fact, Josh has chosen a flick that neither of us has seen, so we'll be announcing that at the very end when we say our goodbyes to you, okay? So again, thanks for writing in, Chris. So what you got, Josh?
Yes. Okay, I got an email from our good friend Ben at Cinecultania.
How you doing?
"Crikey, ahoy Josh and John. With regard to your discussion of cult film..." Okay, I'm not going to do the whole thing like
please,
that.
Please don't. if you do, I'm going to send a crocodile your way to take care of it. A Yakuza crocodile. How about that? A yak croc. How about that? A
yak croc, baby. Come on, you win 5 points. with regard to your discussion of cult films, genre definitely does not imply cult cinema. Cult cinema is not a form of generic type. Cult is the vaguest designation in cinema. It is an umbrella term under which many films lurk from the storm of classical and distribution methods. Cult films are films which grow up unusual. They take a strange path onto the road to popularity, and their audience is one that is grouped by eclectic tastes and unusual interests. Audience is significant to a cult film's definition, but it's just as difficult to describe an absolute form that the audience will take. Beyond those factors, I don't believe cult cinema can really be pinned down much more than that. This is part of its magic, and I personally am against any type of any attempt to absolutely quantify it. This is how attempts at cultdom, such as Snakes on a Plane, fail. Cult films take the road less traveled, be it style, content, production, or distribution, and the audience that awaits it, it finds their own way to that path. Till next time, Ben. P.S. That sample of Alex yelling at me about Japanese porn rocked. Now be sure to listen to Cinecultania, Australia's shiniest film podcast. Cinecultania.blogspot.com or at your nearest iTunes. P.P.S. Love the
you
accents.
You make me watch Japanese porn. I'm making you watch this Pixar film. I don't care what you say.
Can't get enough of that.
Oh, yes. I wonder if they love my Australian accent. It can't be as bad as...
No, it can be.
Southern.
It can be, yes.
Can it?
Yeah.
Oh, crikey.
So anyway.
What do you have to say about that, John?
Cult is something that has to evolve naturally, in my opinion. Take even mainstream films, and I've used this example before. You take something like Heathers, which when it was first released was, of course, a big budget film. It was meant to be sort of like a teen comedy. And of course, it was billed as this dark comedy as well, but I'm not too sure how well it did in the box offices, but it was not until it actually hit video that I remember, for example, my friends quoting these lines from the movie, which was kind of interesting. And even if you take, for example, the whole 80s cinema in general, most of that 80s cinema that we all love was very mainstream stuff. This wasn't made for any kind of cult. This was made to make money with a mainstream audience. So what do you want to say?
on the topic of pseudo cult films and stuff right. like that. I don't know. It's interesting that we've had so many films like that as of recently. Like your new favorite film, what was that?
Yeah, Bitch Slap.
And I watched Ninja Assassin the other night and Zombieland, and I think both of those really kind of fall into that same territory as well. Ninja Assassin I kind of liked because it was like super gory, but yeah, it's ridiculous, Hollywood trying to capitalize on, a niche audience, I guess, which for me, doesn't seem
right. Yeah, I think that's the problem. I mean, that goes along with the issue, not the issue, but what I was talking about with, cult cinema. Cult cinema generally evolves naturally. Usually cult films are ones that are recommended by friends, and then you sort of jump on that bandwagon, so to speak. And I think the films that you're talking about are very much manufactured cult films. These films that are, they have this
prefab.
Prefab movies that they have this audience in mind that they know that they can capitalize from. And I would say, we were just talking about this earlier, that there are some, some examples of this sort of marketing and this sort of creating of these prefab cult films taking to almost a very much of a cynical sort of extreme.
Yeah.
For example, Bitch Slap, I would say, would fall in that category.
Yes.
Something like Mega Shark versus Giant Octopus might also fall in that category. Whereas I think it's fun enough where it's going to garner a cult audience, but... when would you make a movie like Mega Shark versus Giant Octopus except for a cult audience in mind?
Yeah.
And to a certain degree, you can even say things like, you talked about Ninja Assassin, Zombieland, which came out pretty recently. You could basically say that's Fight Club style, stylistic sensibilities mixed with a zombie movie, right? You have something like Grindhouse, which is, actually it's on the good end of these prefab cult films, but it's still prefab, you know? It's not necessarily, it's meant for those who are in the know, so to speak.
Yeah, they let you in on the joke slightly more, mm-hmm. kind of thing. You know, it's generally less, you know, manipulative.
Right.
You know, towards your feelings and stuff like that. And, Eli Roth's, you know, early work, and so does Rob Zombie, House of a Thousand Corpses, and, you know, Cabin Fever. I think both of those could definitely be considered somewhat, you know, manufactured cult films.
Sure,
you know.
Definitely. Okay, well, I guess that's all we have to say about those subjects. We wanted to first actually thank everyone who wrote in. We very much appreciate that. And we encourage everyone else to write in. Our email is vcinema@variedcelluloid.net. And our voicemail is 206-338-3864. For email, if you want to just simplify it, you can send to vcinema@yahoo.com. That's fine, too. It all gets routed to one place. Let's see. We will be back in just a little bit. We're going to announce what we're going to be reviewing next show. And we'll say our last goodbyes and thank yous. So stay tuned for the last little bit. And here we go. Some more music.
Crikey.
Ben's gonna kill you.
If the dogs find anything you're not supposed to have, I'm going to throw your ass in a jail cell overnight with some very bad men who would love to do some very bad things to two skinny boys like you two. Do you understand your choice?
God damn it. You know what, Josh?
What?
I've been checking Jackie Chan's Twitter feed this whole time. And you know what? I did not win one of the red envelopes.
Man,
for those of you who don't know, Jackie Chan has been giving away New Year's red envelopes. Red envelopes are for Chinese. During New Year's, we give envelopes to usually the children of the family that usually contain money or candy or whatever. He didn't choose me. He didn't choose a brother.
Oh, he's racist, dude.
Yeah, I don't know if I can deal with this.
And he's repping Hong Kong.
I think I'm gonna have to write a letter to my attorney.
Whoa.
Yeah.
This is getting serious, man.
Yeah. And speaking of getting serious, we should seriously end the show.
Whoa. Yes.
Wouldn't that be nice?
This episode's going to clock in, what, 5 hours? 4 hours?
Probably at least a couple of days or so.
Wow.
Did the Earth move for you too, Josh? I know it moved for me.
You know it did. You know it did, Ben.
So anyway, we should move off then. Let's end this. Why don't you tell us?
Crikey.
Why don't you tell us what we're going to be reviewing next episode?
Yes, a classic piece of Sugoishi cinema. It's Panic High School.
Great, and that's from 1978, right?
I believe so.
Okay, so why did you choose a Panic High School?
It's obscure. Neither one of us have seen it. And the trailer looks amazing.
Right.
Looks like a kind of a maybe Columbine type situation, actually, you know, which is pretty strange for a Japanese film, and might open some interesting doors.
Right. I wonder if it's based on a manga. It seems like Panic High School. It sounds like the title of a particular manga that I'm thinking of. But anyway, so that's 1978's Panic High School, directed by Sogo Ishii. And just a little reminder, contact us, give us some feedback, send us some discussion topics if you like. Our email is vcinema@variedcelluloid.net. Of course, simply you can use vcinema@yahoo.com. Our voicemail is 206-338-3864. Our Twitter accounts are @vcinemashow and
at buried celluloid.
We also have a fan page on Facebook. You can look it up. It'll be in the show notes, but you can also just go to Facebook and then search for VCinema. I believe we're the only one out there. And, of course, let's give us some thanks out to some people. Go ahead, Josh.
Okay, got a list of people here. We got Rogue Cinema at roguecinema.com, deadlydollshouse.blogspot.com, that's Emily, Heaven's Trash, Heavens with a Z, .blogspot.com, mondomovie.com for the Mondo Movie Podcast, ggtmc.com for the Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, thehorrorgeek.com for our friend Mike Bracken, Shosho, which I mentioned earlier. You can find Shosho on shosho.podomatic.com and shosho.libsyn, cadaverlab.com, cinecultania.libsyn.com, or cinecultania.blogspot.com, outsidethecinema.net, and uncoolcat.blogspot.com.
And I also want to say thank you to my good friend Kemic, who did the intro and outro music for our show. His blog is at dopecomputer.blogspot.com.
Yes.
Right. So again, join us for episode 4, Panic High School 1978, directed by Sogo Ishii. We'll see you next time.
Until then, crikey!